corporate law reform is that a company structure should be God allowed them to bless the characteristics of close cooperation as one of the available options. And secondly, that a simple and easily maintained regime of not-for-profit companies should be maintained, should be developed. Particularly at NASDAQ, it was viewed that the existing regime for the regulation of the not-for-profit companies under the Telecom Companies Act of 1933 was highly formalistic, in the sense that not-for-profit companies, which were registered as such, regardless of their size and their impact on the environment, they were deemed to be public companies in terms of Section 21. And then what that led to was that there were quite a number of regulatory burdens imposed on public companies, which were not necessarily relevant for not-for-profit companies. And at NASDAQ, it was viewed that it is actually very wrong to continue along those lines. And therefore, it was decided that a simple and easily maintained regime for not-for-profit companies should be maintained for not-for-profit companies. And it was also mentioned that cooperatives and partnerships should not be addressed in the reformed company law as the bill currently before you has attempted to do, but that the partnership law should be reviewed at a later stage, because it will actually play a crucial role in reviewing the current partnership law, which is in a very in a state of in a very old state that needs to be reformed. Partnership law is currently regulated under common law and is regulated by a mixture of Rome and Dutch law and the English law, to such an extent that it is quite a difficult basis to know exactly what principles that are applicable to partnership law. And it was mentioned that there is a need for partnership law reform, particularly the introduction of the limited liability partnership in South Africa. It was mentioned that that needs to be done, if not concurrently with this company law reform, immediately thereafter. And secondly, on the issue of flexibility, it was emphasized that an appropriate diversity of corporate structures needs to be implemented. In particular, the need for recognition of the small and medium-sized enterprises and the regulation applicable to them, and the need for improved regulation and improved governance upon your public interest companies. And secondly, it was emphasized that we should not do away with the distinction between listed and unlisted companies, and that it should be retained. And then on the issue of corporate efficiency, it was emphasized that there was a need for a shift from the capital maintenance regime based on par value and nominal capital to the one based on solvency and liquidity. And this is in relation particularly to distributions of companies, particularly because in many jurisdictions with which we share company law traditions, there has been a shift from a purely capital maintenance regime to the one that allows distributions based on solvency and liquidity. And we were helped by the fact that South Africa had already gone in that direction, although halfway is one way to put it that way. As a result of the 1999 amendment to the Companies Act, which led to the amendment of Section 85 and Section 90, dealing with share buybacks and distribution respectively, where the solvency and liquidity test was introduced, although it was not introduced in relation to other capital maintenance requirements as in the legislation. Secondly, is the diversification of board structures and directors' responsibilities, duties, and liabilities. And thirdly, a remedy to avoid locking in minority shareholders in inefficient companies. And here, I think the main emphasis was that there was a need for appraisal rights where we can appropriately place them within the company law, because many of the jurisdictions with which we share company law traditions have actually moved in that direction where investors will not be locked in inefficient companies without any remedy to exit. And fourthly, that mergers and takeovers regime needed to be reformed to facilitate the creation of business combinations. This was an observation which was made in light of the fact that our current Company Act does not in its form provide for a clear measure and amalgamation, but it only provides for a Section 311 business combination, which is basically a scheme of arrangement which involves the share, and as a result was seen as limiting in the sense that many best practice jurisdictions have a major and amalgamation provision which does not only take into account the scheme of arrangement provision and can be done outside the scheme of arrangement provision. And also the realization that the judicial management system for dealing with failing companies was actually not effective, and therefore it needed to be replaced by a more effective business rescue system in the Company Act. By the way, the judicial management system is provided for in the Companies Act under Section 427 following of the 1933 Companies Act. And I must say that it has been taken over from the 1936 Companies Act. And in terms of that particular digital management provision, it has never actually achieved more than 20% of success ever since it was introduced in 1926. And there was a realization that there needed to be a reform of that system. On the issue of transparency, an emphasis was placed on proper recognition of director accountability and appropriate participation of other stakeholders in corporate decision making. And it was emphasized here that director accountability is mainly regulated at common law. And as we will be introducing legislation that will be implemented across all spheres of business entities, there's a need for clear statement relating to director accountability so that even unsophisticated entrepreneurs will be able to know what those statements relating to director accountability are. And secondly, that public announcement, information and prospectus is to be subjected to similar standards for truth and accuracy. That was in line with the fact that certain statements and announcements that are made by public companies in relation to the offer of shares to the public were not subjected to the same standards for truth and accuracy. And there was a need in terms of the negotiations, even at NASDAQ, that this needed to be resolved. And thirdly, the protection of shareholder rights, the advancement of shareholder excuses and provision of enhanced minority protection, minority shareholder protection. This was brought about by the fact that many of the shareholder rights are currently protected or provided for under common law. And there may be inconsistency insofar as the interpretation of common law is concerned. And it was felt at NASDAQ that there was a need to bring this to the fore so that we can be able, so that the investors can be able to know how their rights or what their rights are and how they can be protected. And also the advancement of shareholder activism, particularly because in South Africa, an observation was made that there was a lot of shareholder activity, even in public companies, where one would have assumed that you were sophisticated investors, but there was still a lot of shareholder activity. And it was emphasized that provisions need to be brought in place which will ignite this shareholder activity, or at least help towards encouraging shareholder activity. And also the provision of enhanced protection for minority shareholders in view of the fact that there was an understanding that the Companies Act as it stood, and even as it still stands, the 1973 Act, did not have enough protection for minority shareholders in companies, and therefore it leads to a lot of shareholders not investing in a form of those companies. And also that there should be minimum accounting standards for annual reports of companies. Insofar as the fifth point is concerned regarding predictable regulation, it was emphasized in our negotiations there, and like in relation to the policy document, that the sanctions that are provided for in the Companies Act need to be decriminalized where possible. Particularly because there was a realization that the Companies Act seems to penalize or make every transgression in the company as an offense. And many of those offenses really run out of any policy justification for implementation. For example, there were a number of offenses which basically were linked to failure to load certain documents, which documents may not necessarily lead to the end of companies or may not have any substantial impact on the way in which the company is run. And it was seen as a system which did not have any policy justification for enforcing criminal sanctions. And generally, many of those sanctions were never even brought to court. And I think even if they were brought to court, they would probably not have been disposed of because of the number of such minor actions that could be brought into court, and it would have actually choked the criminal prosecution system in South Africa. And secondly, the enhancement through appropriate bodies and mechanisms, either existing or newly introduced. There was a realization that it may be that the enforcement of the Companies Act may be lacking in the sense that some of the existing mechanisms may be failing us, and therefore there is a need to reform them and also, if possible, introduce new regulatory agencies and mechanisms for the purposes of enforcing the company law. And finally, that there needs to be, the balance needs to be struck between adequate disclosure in the interest of transparency and proper regulation.
Chair, before we go on to the chapters and so on, there are a number of very important policy issues that have been that arrived in the presentation so far. I wonder if we can't pause for a few minutes and comment on that.
We can do so because obviously the policies determine what policies to detect or how much.
Thank you, Chair, if I may proceed. I've been looking at King, especially his book on corporate governance, and also the paper by Professor Blackman, and other bits and pieces. I did miss the presentation here a few months ago, but I've read the minutes of it. I have a number of concerns I'd like to raise and questions. The first one is the question of stakeholders. Now, King says that a company's primary obligation is to its members, namely the shareholders. But there is also an obligation to stakeholders, and they mention things like public health, education, and so on, and suppliers. I'm not sure if I've got all the words right, but there are various people who connect with a company who are also interested parties, and therefore the company has an obligation to them. But it seems to me, given what Professor Blackman says about our constitution, I would say that the public interest is also of importance, not only the members of a company, not only the stakeholders, but the public interest. For example, we've seen how the crash of Enron in America and WorldCom affected not only the stakeholders, not only the shareholders, but the whole stock exchange system in America. And indeed, I have friends in the U.S. who lost their lifetime savings in pension funds because of that crash. So it seems to me that the accountability, which is referred to in the presentation, ought to say somewhere that accountability and transparency is in the interest of shareholders, in other words, members of the company, stakeholders such as, and the public interest, or the public at large. I'm not a lawyer, so I won't formulate it. I think that's an important element, particularly because of the South African Constitution and its requirements for equity, etc., etc. So that's my first point. just to say, if there was a big run on the stock exchange, on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, I think we would all feel the pinch, even if we're not shareholders or members or even stakeholders in the sense that, that King talks about. It's too limited. Second point I would say is governance issues. We, the Fidentia case and the Masterbond case illustrates to us that the public at large, and certainly Parliament, are not adequately informed about the governance implications of bad governance, the consequences. We don't know how companies operate. And it seems to me that somewhere in the bill, recognition should be given to the fact that governance issues is not merely a member for a matter for the members themselves. It's a matter for the country and for, in fact, yeah, for the country as a whole. And therefore, the accountability, transparency issues should be seen in a wider context than normally. It's not just the shareholders who need good governance. So, I mean, for example, the Fidentia scandal and so on has an effect on overseas investors. And that affects the whole of South Africa, not just the shareholders and the company itself. Third point. Somehow one would like, and maybe this is asking too much, that the department gives us some sort of structure of the corporate sector in South Africa. What are we talking about? Now, you've given us some numbers, and I'm grateful for that. It's not often you get those numbers. I appreciate that. But some idea of the structure of what you're talking about. Who are you applying this to? What is the physical character of this thing called the corporate structure of South Africa? We have no idea here. Maybe I'm asking too much there, but some sort of picture of this structure would be useful. Fourth point, and these relate more to the last two or three of your paragraphs. We would like to say something about remuneration. Now, what is happening in South Africa is that chief executives are giving themselves bonuses at a hell of a rate. Should not Parliament have something to say about that? Because these are public entities, although they are private companies. Remuneration. These handouts that a director gets 100 million rand in 1 year as a present. Is that desirable? Are we talking about good governance and yet allowing that sort of thing? Second one is annual reports. Annual reports printed in newspapers are not transparent at all. They are meant for the public. I'm moderately literate in these matters. But, you know, there's so much concealment in those reports. They talk about bottom line. The bottom line is a mixture of all sorts of things. Depreciation is thrown in when it's not depreciation. Rollovers, all sorts of things. Can't we, in terms of this law, lay down a format for the annual report of a company so that when they stick it in the newspaper, we understand it? I would challenge any member on this side here to take apart today's annual report in the newspaper and tell me what it's all about. I bet none of us can do that. So presumably people on the other side can, but we can't. So the annual report, should the act, the bill, not prescribe a certain format for public transparency? And then the question of multiple directorships. We've seen recently that there are people who have multiple directorships, 18 directors, 80 companies. Should the law allow that? Now, I don't want to interfere with the private sector. We want a healthy private sector. We want it to flourish. But things like that are counterproductive. When the chief of a state corporation is a member of 30 companies, a director of 30 companies, that's not good governance. And I think the law should say something. It's a question, really. Is it possible for us to limit the scale of directorships, because what's going on is that a small group of people are members of everything, drawing salaries, drawing returns, whatever you call it, allowances, not working, making no contribution. It's not good for the country. So I would suggest that should be looked at in this law, if it's possible, and that would help good governance in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? If not, we'll continue. This is our second broad overview of the content of the book. So it's our responsibility to engage with it. So after getting the general structure context, we'll obviously give it much more closer attention chapter by chapter. What is happening?
Okay, on corporate efficiency. Corporate efficiency. On C, you are saying a remedy to avoid locking in minority shareholders in inefficient companies. Locking in principle. Would you say that it is correct in efficient companies? How do you draw the distinction between the two, and why the one and not the other?
Thank you. Thank you.
Chair, thanks very much, Chair. With regards to transparency, that's section 4 in slide number 8. Reference is made to minimum accounting standards for annual reports. That triggers a question to me. What about the overall performance? Is it catered for, or would it be stretching it too much to have also some framework on performance standards of companies? Because performance is not just about rents and trends, it's about also the overall performance of any company. I think also what one says, the one thing that is, because recently one has learned particularly from the auditing side, particularly referred to auditing committees, that the paradigm shift is that audit committees not only look at financial performance, the performance auditing goes beyond financial issues, if I'm correct. So I'm sort of influenced by that, by provoking this new dimension, that should we be looking at also that kind of framework is not only for accounting financially, but also generally. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Comrade Market.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Mine is the simplest of all questions. I tried to, too much of the present, I tried to crack my head over a public interest company. The way a person thinks, you want to see it. What is it? Are those companies that are within the PIC? Or what type of company is it? If I could be given an example, are we talking about Sasol? Are we talking about... I understand the NGOs and so on. If that could be unpacked for me so that I see what we are talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Could we perhaps have responses to those comments and submit the question? And thereafter, we continue with the question.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. Let me take this opportunity to thank you for those observations and concerns which have been raised. And I will try to take them one by one, and I'll also ask my colleagues to come in where I feel that maybe they could give adequate answers. But on the first issue that Professor Gilbert raised relating to public interest and the fact that Mr. Keating, Advocate King, in his book, seems to say that accountability is only to the members and not to any other stakeholders. And given the fact that in South Africa we do have the constitution, which provides for the involvement of other stakeholders beyond merely shareholders, I would like to point out that the company law was drafted with the realization that there could be other measures in South African legislative environment which go towards the protection of other stakeholders, and where that is effectively provided for in other legislative instruments, there was no need seen to be provided for in other in this legislation. Particularly because we would run a risk of providing for example, for environmental issues in this legislation or for labor issues in this legislation, when there are labor legislation like the Labor Relations Act and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and other related legislation. And therefore, this legislation basically goes to the heart of the determination of the relationship between the company on the one hand, the shareholders on the other, and the other participants who may be suppliers because of their continued throwing of a lifeline on the company. But without necessarily moving away from the crux of company law, which is to ensure the balance between the rights and responsibilities of directors and shareholders. Although we do acknowledge that in other instances, company law should be able to provide for a balance to include other stakeholders, and I think we have done so in relation to other issues, for example, on the area of corporate rights, which is dealt with under Chapter 6 of the proposed bill. On the second issue, relating to governance issues, Professor has mentioned that the governance issue is a matter for the country as a whole, given the fact that governance basically, or failure of governance will actually affect all the citizens of South Africa, whether they know it or not. And he gave the example of Enron and other recent scandals in South Africa. That is an acknowledgement that has been made in South Africa, and that is why, insofar as enforcement is concerned of this legislation, the department, through this proposed bill, has provided for a very robust or mixture of enforcement mechanisms through which the governance will basically not only be the issue of shareholders alone, but will be the issue of the public as a whole, and also the issue of government involvement where it is necessary, as you can see from Chapter 8 of this legislation. Another issue under governance related to the structure of South African companies. I must say that insofar as that is concerned, we have given the honorable members the statistics, but as I heard from honorable members, that may not be sufficient because there's a need to drill deeper into the statistics. This is in your slide number 10. And I must say that if we would like to unpack that, we would need to go to the very heart of the shareholding of those companies or membership of those companies in order to see what kind of structure we have. And I must say that our research shows that in all the private companies which constitute about 24% of all registered entities on our register, more than 70% of those are owner-managed, in the sense that they are family-owned businesses in certain instances, or businesses that are owned by friends or related persons. And as such, those related persons are usually shareholders on the one hand and also on the management on the other. And I must that characteristic is characteristic of a closed corporation. They have given for over 70% of those 412,235 companies which are fully managed. And you've got over 1,276,000 closed corporations which are owned and managed. It seems that if the majority of businesses on our register are actually owned and managed. And as a result, there is a need for a law that is aimed at trying to resolve issues that arise in owned and managed companies. Obviously, the public companies are not as such. They are not owned and managed. And let me go back to the issue of private companies as well. Around 30% of all the registered private companies are mainly companies that are constituted by shareholders who are themselves juristic persons. And in most cases, they are listed companies which will fall under the public companies which constitute about 3,757 of the registered entities in South Africa. Therefore, it means that you've got a very intricate system of ownership insofar as the main 30% is concerned, where you've got a company which is a private company and subject to a more flexible regime, but which mainly is a company that is held, or the shares of which are held, by listed companies which are also public companies. And insofar as public companies are concerned, you would understand that there's a separation of ownership from control. In the sense that you've got quite widespread number of shareholders and that the governance of companies is actually undertaken by those who are in control and who are the directors. And of those, only 440 are listed on the stock exchange or have their securities listed on the stock exchange. The number was slightly higher. I think in 2001, the number was about 630, and it came down over the years to 440 by the end of 2006. And the number of reasons which were quoted for delisting of a number of companies was the process of going private on the one hand, and also others quoted the problem of a regulatory burden which were created upon them or were imposed upon them by the listing requirements and also legislation that seems to have been imposed upon listed companies. Those are some of the reasons which were mentioned for the delisting of many of the companies. But many of those companies that are listed on the stock exchange are basically held by a mixture of both the institutional shareholders and the individual shareholders. And In a situation where there are institutional shareholders, you've got pension funds, which basically will hold an equity investment on behalf of a number of millions of South Africans who are in different working environments, and you would have other institutional shareholders like the medical fund who would invest in such companies, and as a result, you do have a mixture of individual shareholders who hold in their personal capacity and institutional shareholders who are run by the fund manager who holds the shares on behalf of different investors, be it in the way of unit trust, be it in the way of pension funds. I don't think that there is any question that could be asked as to the nature of incorporated companies that constitute about 7,976 of registered companies, because those are really your 1763B companies. These are your attending practices, your accounting practices, your auditor practices, and those that can only undertake their business through this form of business undertaking without necessarily being exposed to the uncertainties that were stated of the partnership law in South Africa. And therefore, those are pretty much the privately owned companies, which just happen to be in the professional industry. And they just did not want to use the partnership form for the purposes of doing business, because that is limited in the sense that partnership law restricts the number of partners to 20. And this particular legislation does not restrict the number of memberships to 20. But given this regime incorporated as a private company, it will be restricted to 50, excluding employees and former employees. And if there's any, I don't think that we need to go into detail about other entities, but if you would like us to, as a department, to drill more into what we have already given you, we would be so much happy to go and do a research on that. The next issue related to remuneration. I must point out that remuneration, according to our research, excessive remuneration has been seen to be a major problem, particularly in listed companies. And what has happened over the years is that the corporate governance reforms have tried to address this issue. And the corporate governance reforms have addressed this issue through the codes of corporate governance. And in South Africa in particular, we have seen the King Code in 1994, and also the King Code that was introduced in 2001 and implemented in 2002. What has happened insofar as listed companies are concerned is that the ASE has actually taken the listing, the King Code, and made it part and parcel of the listing requirements, and requiring information relating to individual directors of remuneration of individual directors. And it has actually led to a significant drop, because, you know, exposure or disclosure is the greatest factor. We have seen that a number of companies that have been paying excessively high remuneration as a result of the fact that their information was going to be in the public domain, that trend has actually fallen down. And it is addressed in this bill by requiring disclosure of remuneration in the annual report of companies, and that is addressed in Chapter 4. The issue of annual report. You mentioned the issue of annual report. Is there anyone from my team who would like to come in? Oh, thank you.
On the issue of remuneration, SEPO has already shown to us that the issue of disclosure is very important. But in the same policy, the issue of shareholder execution, if it is really that the shareholders themselves can block that nobody should get so much, but because of that apathy which has already indicated, then it is not happening. But this may lead to a proper governance issue. You have to account to the shareholders, and therefore if you are not, if you are here for higher salary, you will drop it. Then I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Going to the issue of annual report, a concern was raised by Honorable Member Chulov that financial report should not, the annual report should not necessarily emphasize the issue of financial reporting, but it should include other performance which may go beyond the finances. We do acknowledge
and the format, the form, some format,
and the format. Yes, we do acknowledge that that is something that could be dealt with within the bounds of this legislation. And if I may say that the legislation envisages the creation of the Financial Reporting Standards Council, and the Corporate Laws Amendment Act envisages the creation of the Financial Reporting Standards Investigation Panel. Both those bodies will be responsible for ensuring that in the annual report, the format is such that it will be understandable and it will comply in many instances, particularly insofar as public interest companies are concerned, to international financial reporting and standard. And as a result, it's something that could be provided for by way of regulation when the financial reporting standard council is introduced. The issue of multiple directorships. This has been a serious problem in South African law ever since we took over corporate legislation from the UK in 1926, after the Union, which was our first legislation. The issue of multiple directorships has never been addressed in any legislation before. And I must say that it is not even addressed in this legislation as well. The issue is that at common law, there's a rule that says that a director is entitled to sit in as many boards as possible, as long as it will not compromise the director's performance in any one company. And that rule has been taken over by the King's Report of 2002, and it has been made a part and parcel of the decision requirement. And we find that this is a problem insofar as your public companies are concerned, and it is not really a big issue in relation to your smaller companies. And as such, that is clearly covered by the King Code and also by the recent requirements. And where there's a need for this legislation to cover that area, we will investigate the possibility that that should be done without necessarily imposing burdensome requirements upon your closely held companies that do not experience this problem. Another issue was raised by another member later to looking in minority shareholders in inefficient companies. Why the one and not the other? I think this point came up at NEDLAC because of the lack in South Africa of a remedy involving appraisal and exit of shareholders in South Africa. The resolution of this point will not necessarily lead to favoritism of those that shareholders who are in inefficient companies, but it will actually even include shareholders who are in companies where they just want to exit. We know that the liquidity of investment in public companies is very high, and therefore in many cases, if the shareholder is not satisfied with the governance of a public company, the best way is just to exit, and will be exited by getting a shareholder who is interested in buying his investment for a good price that he is asking. But in a private company, the problem has been exacerbated, particularly by the provisions of Section 20 of the current Companies Act, which provides that a private company must, in terms of these articles of association, provide for the restriction of the transferability of its shares. And now what has happened is that the restriction of the transferability of its shares has actually led to articles of association being drafted in such a way that a shareholder would be obliged to sell his shares to one of the existing members, or if not so, the director of the company before he can offer those shares to any other person, who should be approved also by the management of the company. Now, what has happened is that has led to shareholders being locked in companies, particularly where they're inefficient and shareholders want to leave. You will find that you are not at ease to just dispose of your investment. Now, that is why, in terms of Section 165, we have realized that a number of issues arise where there is some sort of a business combination. There is some sort of a business combination, or there is an amalgamation between different companies that shareholders will be mostly oppressed, and that is why we have linked this remedy to a process of amalgamation and a process of merger where companies are oppressed. And we're saying that under such circumstances, shareholders who are objecting to such a transaction should be entitled to exit, and the company should be obliged to appraise their shares at a fair value and then be able to buy them out. And we have also extended the remedy of prejudicial conduct under Chapter 7, which entitles the shareholder to be able to go to the company and require that his shares be bought at a favorable price that will be determined in accordance with the order of the court. And under such circumstances, it will be clear that our law will actually favor shareholders who would like to exit in companies, irrespective of whether they're efficient or inefficient. The issue of minimum accounting standards for annual reports would go beyond finances. I've already dealt with that. I think it was raised for the second time. And the third issue related to, or the final issue related to public interest companies, and as to what it means. Now, the term of public interest company is defined in Section 9 of this legislation. We will come to it when we come on the presentation on Chapter 1 and 2, and it will be made clear. But briefly, it is basically a company that, according to its structure and according to its fund, is of such importance in the public domain that it requires more restrictive or strict governance and financial reporting requirements. And that will be a company that is widely held, and for a lack of better term, that is the equivalent of a public company. And secondly, it will be a closely held company that meets certain threshold requirements. We will deal with that when we come to Chapter 1 and discuss with under Section 1. Thank you, Chapter 1.
Thank you very much.
I'm
prepared that we proceed. I'm sure there will be some other questions for and comments for further elaboration as we go.
I am not mistaken. I'm a secretary.
I no longer intend to go deep into the slide number 10 on the figures of corporate landscape in South Africa, but what I just want to emphasize is that at the time when the policy was being developed, there was a realization that within the broader economic context in South Africa, there was a need to bridge the gap between the first and the second economies in South Africa, particularly because many of the businesses were seen as undertaking business in the informal sector and as such not in the ladder screen for its prospects. And our research has revealed that just over 749,000 business entities are operating in the informal economy, and those constitute about 23.8% of all of the total enterprises in the economy. And also our research revealed that just over 699,156 companies are businesses are registered with SARS as business entities, and this will be sole proprietorships and partnerships. And they constitute about 22.2% of all the total enterprises in the economy. And the intention within the policy document was to try to encourage or incentivize these businesses, which are more or less in the informal economy, to join the formal economy by being registered as such and therefore having corporate personality and all the advantages that come with doing business. And also been available to avail themselves to all the benefits and incentives that are provided for within government, and been within the radar screen so that they can be exposed to our statistics in South Africa generally. Now, this is the scheme of the bill, honorable members. The bill is divided into 9 chapters and has got 6 schedules. And even in our updating of the bill, it's unlikely that it will be, it will have more than 9 chapters and more than 6 schedules. And I must say that this is a major achievement from South Africa, because very few countries, and even those with which we share company law traditions, have managed to provide for core company law in so few chapters. I mean, an example will be Australia. Australia has tried to encompass, by way of regulation, every aspect of company law. And I think they've got over 5,000 sections in their Corporation Act of 2001. And the latest legislation to be passed in the UK by the UK Parliament is the Companies Act of 2006. It has over 1,300 sections and over 16 schedules. And it is basically by far the largest or the most voluminous legislation ever passed by UK legislature ever since it was incepted. And you can imagine how many years are those. And one of their main objectives in their policy reform was simplification of legislation. And Professor Thiele had a lot of things to say about the relationship between that particular objective and the voluminous nature of that legislation. And the intention here for making sure that we restrict the number of chapters and schedules to the ones that we have is to provide for core company legislation, because we realize that many of the issues that are regulated by other comparable legislation in companies with which we share company law traditions are basically matters that are dealt with in other legislation. And we are satisfied that this will cover core company law, and as such it will be sufficient, more especially if we do not want to confuse unsophisticated entrepreneurs. We do not want to be regulation for all and sundry in the way of corporate legislation. Mr. Chairperson, should I go then straight to chapter 1? I see that we just after 11 o'clock, and I think we can just proceed to chapter 1, unless there are questions on the remaining issues that have been raised.
I suggest that we do continue when and if they bring kids. I would suggest people disassist themselves, because starting at 10 obviously shortens the time that we have available. And then unfortunately there's another meeting next door, which is very robust. So one picks up all the tidbits that get through that crack. So I'm not sure if there's a slide chatbot thing there. I'm not sure if you can try and do that. Chat, I'll check in our economy. You can do this. No, from here, from the front, there's a leg of something sticking out there. If you can push it to where it belongs, and if you can do that, you might be able to cut down some of that background.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I think we can start with chapter 1. Chapter 1 will resolve many of the issues that emanated, particularly insofar as public interest company, what constitutes public interest company, and what are the considerations that we take into account. I thought we should start from the beginning. Now, chapter 1 is basically divided into two main chapters, two main parts, part A and part B. Part A is basically important in the sense that it contains a number of definitions which are not currently contained under the 1973 legislation. As you can see from the slide there, the bill contains about 100 definitions as it stands, as opposed to the 43 definitions contained in the 1973 Companies Act, which is the current legislation. Now, the reason for such a high number of definitions is caused by the fact that the new definitions were introduced because of the many new substantive provisions which require new definitions. And many of them may be new in the South African corporate sphere. And those include the term amalgamation, they include the term closely held company. We will go into those terms when we come to the chapters dealing specifically with those issues. But I just thought I should just highlight those issues because I think they will be important when we discuss them at a later stage.
Chair,
just on definitions, would it be possible to include, I've looked at the definition here, would it be possible to include a definition of the public interest? Because this is a point I'm afraid I'm going to raise again. If I may, Chair, I think I was not totally understood but on that first point. It seems to me in a company there are the shareholders and directors, there are the stakeholders who are suppliers and so on, but then there's the public interest, which is different. And it seems to me that this bill ought at some stage to say something about how the bill might impact corporate governance and so on, might impact on the public interest. It's a separate from the shareholders.
If possible.
We will definitely look into that issue, honourable member. And if we introduce it in the bill, we will definitely have to introduce a clear definition in chapter one. Is there any other question before we go forward?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to comment that sometimes in a legislation, it is not wise to put open-ended terms or terms that are open to wide definitions, especially if it's a legislation that is designed for a specific purpose. Historically, a company is a business, different types of businesses, the public companies, the private companies. There's reasons for a public company, reasons for a private company. Now, if you want to define public interest or bring in public interest in the domain of corporate governance, you're actually going further than just socializing an otherwise capitalistic entity and making it more of a, I don't know, even the church, it's not. Not everybody goes in the same church. I don't know how to describe it, but I think that if you want to take the issue of this legislation has actually attempted to introduce social aspect of a business, like as you have pointed out, taking into account interests of suppliers, interests of labor organizations, so on and so forth. But I think if you want to cut it the net very wide, you might bring in a lot more problems than solutions. This is just
I understand, but I don't agree.
I think at this juncture, the issue has been flagged. Let's just give it attention. I think that will suffice. Let's give it attention within the context of company law. Some of us have got a great appreciation of how the law operates, but the value of having members who are not lawyers themselves is how the law impacts to those who do not use legalese, so that we get to be able to cater for all the possibilities there. I'm not sure what's happening next Thursday. If we are having a happy hour at the same time, what's happening next? What meeting is this? What committee is this? Really, it's getting difficult. It's like a church next to shipping. The two are both social entities, but their interests don't always coincide. my apologies, but next time we should try and get to a venue where we don't have to see and hear the next committees, if possible. I'll appeal that we just try and focus as best as we can. Thank you.
The part which has raised a number of comments and observations, particularly after the exposure of the draft from the 12th of February, is part B of chapter 1. And this is important in so many respects, particularly to start at the beginning, because it provides for the objectives or the purposes of the Companies Act in Section 6. And those purposes that are reflected in Section 6 reflect the objectives for company law reform that I have referred to earlier on in my slide. Many of you will remember them, that were taken also to NEDLAC, and they are in slide number 5. And those objectives are basically reflected as the purposes for Companies Act, and that any kind of court or tribunal which interprets any provision of this legislation must do it in line with its purposes. And you will bear with me, or you will agree with me, that in promoting these purposes, many of the issues that have been raised this morning in relation to policy will basically be resolved, because that means that in enforcing, for an example, transparency and high standards of corporate governance in companies, the court may be forced under certain circumstances to require, or a tribunal may be forced under certain circumstances to require companies to disclose, for an example, remuneration, and to be able to put that to the shareholders of the company for their decision. And that being the case, I have said that in brief what the purpose does is that it promotes economic development of companies in economic development, companies, innovation and investment in South Africa. It reaffirms the role of the company, it balances the rights and obligations of shareholders and directors in particular. And the most important provision in Part B is that which deals with categories of companies, and it's Section 8. Now, Section 8 basically provides that companies in South Africa will be divided between for-profit and not-for-profit companies. Now, for-profit companies are in other jurisdictions with which we share company law traditions, in particular Canada and USA, are referred to as business corporations. These are the kind of companies in which investors invest with a view to gaining a return on their investment, unlike with not-for-profit companies, which may include social objectives and also common objectives like societies and churches and other related institutions. The most important, or the one that is of utmost importance for the purposes of this bill, are the business corporations or your for-profit companies. And these are in terms of Section 8 of the proposed companies bill, divided into two types. You've got a widely held company on the one hand and a closely held company on the other. And for a lack of a better term, I would say that a widely held company is the equivalent of the current public company as we have it under Section 32 of the Companies Act 1973. And for a lack of a better term, a closely held company is basically a mixture of your close corporation on the one hand and your private company on the other. And we remember that one of the objectives that we set out at the beginning was the simplification of corporate legislation. And we have said that it has been embellished in our negotiations at NEDLAC to mean that one of the corporate structures that have to be put in place have to have the characteristics of a close corporation. Now, this is the type of a company that has got the characteristics of both a close corporation and a private company. A closely held company is basically an opposite of a widely held company. The bill defines a widely held company as a company which, in terms of its memorandum of incorporation, remembering that the memorandum of incorporation will be the only governing document of a company, as opposed to the current memorandum of memorandum of association and articles of association, you have memorandum of incorporation as the only governing document. The advisory health company is a company which, in terms of the governing document, firstly permits it to offer any of its shares to the public. Secondly, it limits, negates, or restricts the preemptive right of every shareholder. And thirdly, it provides for the unrestricted transferability of any of these shares. Therefore, it means that its securities are pretty much liquid. And therefore, these are basically the first and the last one are basically the characteristics of the current company, or the company, the public company, as you know it, under the Companies Act. I must come back to the second point. The second point, honorable members, has raised a lot of concerns among the commentators who have commented on the bill. That is, that in terms of its memorandum of incorporation, it permits the company to offer any of, it limits or negates a preemptive right of every shareholder provided for in Section 36. The reason why this has caused a lot of controversy among the commentators is because they are arguing that a preemptive right is just that, a right to be offered the shares first before they are offered to anyone. And the arguments are that that should not be a distinguishing factor for a wealthy health company. Because a company that limits or restricts a preemptive right of every shareholder does not necessarily mean that it is a wealthy health company. Because even a company that could restrict the preemptive right of every shareholder, it is still possible to for that company to not permit it to offer its shares to any of its public and to provide for restricted transferability of its shares in the memorandum of incorporation. And as such a company will be a closely held company. And we are reviewing within the department the inclusion of this second leg of preemptive right of shareholders as one of the distinguishing factors of a widely held company. But I am pretty much certain that the first and the last will remain, because these were basically the distinguishing factors that are currently contained in Section 20 of the Companies Act, which distinguish a private company from a public company, which, just to refresh the honorable members' memory, is that firstly, a company must, in terms of its article of association, restrict the transferability of its shares, and secondly, that the company must prohibit its shares to be offered to the public, and thirdly, that it must limit the number of its shareholders to 50, excluding employees. You will realize that we have taken out the limit of the number of shareholders in the equation, and particularly even for closely held companies, there isn't such, because a closely held company is the opposite of a widely held company. Therefore, to our understanding and according to the research that we have undertaken, we realize that that particular limitation does not serve any purpose. Basically, it is quite restricting to a number of businesses that would have more than 50 shareholders, but they are, by their very nature, very closely held. They cannot constitute themselves as private companies under the current Companies Act. And it has led to quite very restrictive, unnecessary restrictive.
Can I ask a question, please? Are you talking about preference shares? And I don't understand the whole share business. Is it possible to give us a sort of list of the kinds of shares that companies actually have? Voting shares, non-voting, A and B, preference and all that. Is it possible to give us some sort of an explanation at some stage?
Yes, I think I can be able to do that, honorable member. Currently, the Companies Act provides that the memorandum or the articles of association can be able to prescribe any rights attaching to shares. Now, what has happened is that practice in South Africa and in other comparable jurisdiction has been to divide shares into a number of classes, the most common of which are your ordinary shares, which may also have their own denomination, and you've got, secondly, your preference shares, which are likely to have their own denominations as well, and you've got mainly under the preference shares, you've got those preference shares that are cumulative in the sense that this is a dividend that has not been paid to them in one particular year, it could have been accumulated over a number of years. And you've got preference shares which are redeemable and those that are not redeemable. Preference shares which are redeemable are more like your debt, debt instrument as opposed to your...
Maybe not now, Chair. I don't want to disrupt the flow.
Okay.
But at some stage you can give us a piece of paper or a lecture. I think this is complicated stuff.
Okay, no.
Why do you pose the question? But I think this overall aid memoir for members as it was, as to what the different shares. I don't think it will be an exercise law. And then later on you could provide that in writing. But just very briefly, what type of shares there are, so that we have each other back of the mind. It will assist members.
Yeah, we will provide a more detailed thing later on. But briefly, you've got ordinary shares. And ordinary shares usually entitle a member to, or shareholder to, basically three rights. And those three rights are basically a right to vote and participate at meetings of the company. And secondly, a right to participate in a dividend of the company when it is declared. And thirdly, a right to participate in the surplus asset of the company after liquidation. Those are the three basic rights of an ordinary shareholder. But as I've already said, companies are able to then distinguish between those ordinary shareholders as to what rights will attach to them and at what point will they vote and at what point they will not vote. Now, the second type is basically preference shares. Preference shares are the shares that have got preference either in relation to capital or in relation to dividends over your ordinary shareholders. That means that when the company declares a dividend, the first people who have to be paid, and usually up to a percentage before the ordinary shareholders are paid, are preference shareholders. And this has been a mechanism that has been adopted a long time ago by companies to attract shareholders or equity financiers in a situation where equity financing may not be seen to be a very good model of investment. But given the fact that of the possibility of being paid first before the ordinary shareholders, you would find other people who would be interested in investing in such companies. And now, there are redeemable shares. Redeemable shares are usually your preference shares, a subset of preference shares. Redeemable shares are those shares that usually have a preference in relation to the dividend and the capital up to a certain percentage, but then they must be redeemed by the company at an agreed time in the future. What that means is that a company must, in 5 years from now, be able to buy back those shares. And it is a forced redemption because the company is entitled in terms of the contract, which is the articles of association, to buy those shares back from the shareholder. And at that point, when the time has arrived, the shareholder is pretty much sure that he would have at least acquired his investment over the years that he has been investing in the company. But those briefly are the different types of shares. But we can provide a more lengthy.
Thank you very much.
The second most important provision is Chapter 9. It's Chapter 9, which deals with a public interest company. Now, a public interest company is not a third category of a company. Remember, honorable members, I have said that the bill provides for two categories of companies, your for-profit company and your not-for-profit company. And now probably when I'm talking about the public interest company, you're probably thinking this is another or a third type of a company. No, the bill provides that this is an overriding category, which may include any of those other companies that I have referred to. And basically what a public interest company is that it is in the first place, a widely company is automatically a public interest company. You can understand why the public element comes in for the insofar as widely held companies are concerned, given the, particularly the first and the last criterion for determining a public, a widely held company, in the sense that it permits it to offer any of its shares to the public. And finally, that it provides for the unrestricted transferability of its shares it means that all and sundry, almost everybody can be able to hold shares in that particular company, and there's no restriction as to the number, the maximum number of shareholders in there. And therefore, it is quite clear as to why it would be identified as a public interest company. And the importance of this category, overriding category, is so that those financial reporting requirements and corporate governance requirements that are provided for in the bill will be appropriately placed rather than applying them across the board, in which cases they may be regulatory burdens for other companies. If we have identified these types of companies and be able to clearly define them for the purposes of such restrictive governance and financial reporting, then you would have done justice to other companies that do not need over-regulation through that. And remembering that this is the agreement that was reached even at NEDLAC between participants, constituencies, in relation to the way in which companies' bill has to be drafted. And that is the first company that can be a public interest company. Secondly, your for-profit company, that is a closely held company, may still become a public interest company if basically, according to the bill, two criteria are met. Firstly, the criterion relates to science. It relates to science in the sense that if a company satisfies any two of the three thresholds that are set in the bill, then that company will be classified as a public interest company. And those thresholds basically are, firstly, the annual turnover, and secondly, the annual asset value, and thirdly, the number of employees. Now, for the purposes of your for-profit companies, your closely held company will be categorized as a public interest company if its annual turnover is 50 or more than 50 million rand, and if its monetary value of assets exceeds over 25 million, and if it employs 200 or more employees. If it meets any two of those three, must meet the three. And for a not-for-profit company, it will be categorized as a public interest company if it meets two of the following three thresholds: a 20 million rand annual turnover, a monetary asset value of 10 million, and an employment threshold of not less than 50 employees. This is just the breakdown of the categories of companies that we have them under the bill. I think maybe the best
here, if I may, with your permission, I'm looking at the definition of public interest in the bill itself, as well as what you outlined. I wonder whether it wouldn't be wise to ask the state law advisor to tell us whether public interest is defined in any other legislation. Because otherwise, your definition of a public interest company is based on three categories, as I can see, which are rather technical, and yet includes things like supply of essential goods. Now, that's a very wide term. A company which supplies essential goods is a public interest company, if I'm right. So, I think we need a little kind of, if you like, philosophical underpinning to this kind of stuff, because the supply of essential public goods ought to be defined. You know, I can see a court of law having enormous trouble over this. If there's a dispute whether A is a public interest company or not, on the basis of whether it supplies essential public goods. You know, so I think somewhere we need a, as I say, a philosophical justification for this language. And maybe the state law advisor can help.
Yes, through you, Mr. Chesterton. We do acknowledge that that may be a problem, and many of the commentators who have commented on this bill have actually pointed out to the second way in which a company can be categorized as a public interest company. Remember that the first one is in relation to tax. The second one is the discretion of the minister. And the bill says that the discretion of the minister will have to be taken within the confines of this this stated objectives. And we acknowledge that they may be going too far. But what needs to be understood is that the minister will have to make a decision as to what those public interest companies are in a government gabinet. And he would have exercised his discretion and applied his mind in relation to that categorization. And we are, of course, going to submit this bill to the state law advisors after we have considered all the comments that we are currently reviewing, which we have received until, I think, around 2 weeks ago. And we are hoping that we will be finished by the 31st of May, by which time that the bill will then be taken back to the commentators for their further review, if ever they've got any further review. And then thereafter it will be taken to, will be introduced in this committee for introduction in Parliament and also to Cabinet and be taken to the State Law Advisors.
I must just say that as we go along, we'll obviously take comments and questions. But in this whole process, we are not just restricted for an opinion from the state law advisor. Within our program, we'll also provide for stakeholder comments, public hearings, so that before the finalization, we're able to get on board all these, also those people who have interacted on their own with the department. But we have a public process, and then obviously thereafter get the department to engage further. Comrade Sisa.
The chair, still around the definition or regarding the software public interest company, you know, one appreciates, you know, the inclusion of substantial impact on environment, particularly, you know, what is going around these days, you know, sensitivity to environment, you know, and its maintenance. And on the same breath, wouldn't it be a valid point to actually include substantial impact on employment? There's a lot that one can refer to. You know, there have been areas, particularly small geographies, where, you know, big companies, the substantial loss of employment has had a big impact on those communities. I think the emphasis to me here is around substantial impact, which is, I would argue, it's in the public interest because of the ramifications and the impact thereof. Thank you.
Thank you. There's another issue flagged. If you want to take comments on that, you may do so. And then let's continue. It's going to be a long walk, but we'll have to engage in this long walk.
Just a clarity for the department to apply its mind correctly. The last 2 points by the honorable members. I will revolving again on the issue of public interest. I'm not talking about public interest companies. I'm talking about public interest issues. Are we revolving around those issues again? So that we have a clear understanding when we go back for application of our mind.
My understanding from the two inputs that you refer to, they have an access to the public interest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having said that, I'm sure that many of you will be asking yourself as to, then what? You've got public interest companies, then what? The process of identifying a company as a public interest company was preceded by a survey as to what are those restrictive or a more stringent regulatory environment that will need to be applied to such companies given their importance in the economy. And as such, we have identified a number of points and a number of requirements with which these companies have to comply, which will not necessarily have to be complied with by closely held companies which are not necessarily public interest companies. And some of them include the following: that in terms of Section 15 of the bill, a public interest company must file its memorandum of incorporation with the commissioner. Now, the commissioner is the head of the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, which we will speak about, which will be a body instituted as a result of a combination of a merger between the functions within the Department of Trade and Industry and the Companies and Intellectual Property Registration Office. And secondly, that in terms of Section 79, a public interest company must hold an annual general meeting specifically provided for in terms of the legislation, and that in terms of Section 79.5, a public interest shareholder or members meeting must be accessible within the Republic for electronic participation, and also that a public interest company has a higher minimum number of directors. If I'm not mistaken, in terms of Section 84, it's 3 or 4 public interest companies. And Section 94, a public interest company must keep a director's register. And Section 96 and 97 contemplate a more stringent financial reporting standard to be prescribed for public interest companies. And this will be prescribed, of course, by the Financial Reporting Standard Council, as I've already, or in consultation with the Financial Reporting Standard Council, as I've already pointed out. And what is envisaged here is that the Financial Reporting Standards Council will replace the current APB, Accounting Practices Board, which is currently responsible in the private sector for determining the standards for mainly your public companies and mainly your listed companies. And therefore, your public interest companies will be subject to internationally acceptable financial reporting standards as opposed to the other companies.
Comrade Chair, I'm a bit confused. Do we have to ask questions as it goes, or must we? Okay.
I think because of the nature of the presentation, you can just ask clarity as we go along.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Whilst I was reading through this thing yesterday, I was interested. Somewhere where they say, on the other hand, it may be held, meetings may be held anyway, meaning that maybe outside the Republic, if that is my understanding. I was just interested to where does that come from? What type of meetings, and why was it necessary that this must be included here? Thank you, Comrade.
The provision for this came out of the realization that shareholders of companies may be in very different places at the different times for many reasons. And as such, if the legislation is only going to restrict the holding of the meetings within the Republic, it will basically to be restrictive. Particularly if the shareholders agree among themselves that meetings could be held somewhere outside the Republic. But we are saying in the legislation that such meetings, even though they are held outside the Republic, they must be easily accessible for all members for participation through other means, even though they are outside the Republic. But the realization is that capital is invested basically everywhere through the click of the mouse, and you can have majority of shareholders who are not necessarily resident in the Republic of South Africa, but a company which is registered in South Africa. And under such circumstances, it may be very restrictive where you require that the majority of the shareholders who are not within South Africa should have the meeting within the Republic at all times. I think under such circumstances, it will be quite restrictive upon such companies.
Just a follow-up. You see, I'm trying to think. I'm a slow thinker, but I'm thinking of a situation whereby
such a happening in South Africa, decided somewhere in Washington. Meetings about companies.
Washington
Well, it doesn't make any legal sense to anybody, but on a present anyway, it gives me a bit of a problem. If a person is interested in having business in South Africa, even if it doesn't make any sense legally, I think to show seriousness, he or she must come here to hold meetings. Thank you.
Chair, that was a rider on that. If the presenters can just share the applicability of legislation, the overall legislation, I think also, I mean, because, I mean, you're holding a meeting outside South Africa. There are a number of laws that always affect and are linked to activities. I'm not sure whether it could only be this piece of legislation, Chair, that we're handling. You know, if we hold a meeting in Munich of a company based in South Africa. Is my understanding correct that the laws that would be applicable to those resolutions taken there would be South African laws? Maybe to put it simply.
So, to the South Africa, yes. Because the company will be a company that is registered and regulated in terms of the Companies Act of South Africa. But what we are saying is that even though those meetings are held outside the Republic, they should be reasonably acceptable for other shareholders who are not outside South Africa by any other means, including electronic participation, where their views could be heard and recorded. And as such, it is not something that is actually excluding other shareholders from decision-making in the process. Honourable Members, the point that I wanted to make also was that the requirement to have financial statements is not, in terms of Section 97, is not dependent on whether a company is a public interest company, but all companies are required to produce financial statements. Although the requirement to lodge such financial statements may necessarily depend on whether you are a public interest company. All companies must prepare financial statements, but companies that are not public interest companies must keep those financial statements at their registered office, and those financial statements will be made acceptable to particularly shareholders, as Section 27 provides, that they must be made accessible to shareholders upon request. And in terms of Section 100, public interest companies must have audit committees, they must appoint auditors, and they are subject to stricter audit practices than non-PI companies. And this will include the rotation of auditors and the membership of audit committees is also subject to independence. And in terms of Section 104, the requirement to have a company secretary applies only to widely held companies, which are basically public interest companies. And in terms of Section 161, public interest company must implement their regime to accept and deal with whistleblower concerns.
Chair, could I ask, what is the difference between a holding company and a company? And Fidentia seems to have managed to move money around different companies, or was it trusts? So how does this law work in relation to a holding company, whatever, an ordinary company, and any other entity? How does this work?
I may not answer your question directly because the question is quite broad, but from my understanding, a holding company is a company which holds a majority of shares in other companies. And as such, those companies are subsidiaries of this parent company. We call it parent and subsidiary. And as such, the law here, and if you are a holding company of those companies, closed companies, you are, by your very nature, a public interest company. And as such, you would be required to have a audit committee. And such an audit committee will be subject to independence. And the law says that in the situation where your audit committee performs functions of audit committees in respect of your subsidiaries are under no obligation to appoint an audit committee because that will be provided for by your parent company. But there should be independence insofar as audit committees are concerned. And insofar as trusts are concerned, trusts are not subject to this legislation. Trusts are not regulated in terms of the Companies Act. They are regulated in terms of Trust Property Control Act and the common law. And it is quite a very confusing mixture, because at common law, the law relating to trust is almost similar to the law relating to partnership, which is a mixture of Roman Dutch law and some principles of English law, and it is in dire need of reform. But I must say that that is not the area for the Department of Trade and Industry. It's basically the Department of Justice, which is responsible for administering trust through the Master's Office. But be that as it may, I must say that the legislation only concentrates on companies which are jurisdiction in terms of this legislation.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, sir.
Can I just affirm on the point of principle, despite the fact that a subsidiary company is a separate entity for legal purposes from the parent company, it's got its own separate legal business. It's just a business efficiency. Sort of expediency that makes the relationship possible. Otherwise, a subsidiary is a company on its own.
Right. Both fall under this act.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's got its own obligations, but in terms of the current law, when the parent company reports, it's got to have consolidated financial statements of the subsidiary companies. That's the requirement. I just wanted to affirm that.
Chair, I trust as we move along, amongst other things, the relations between parent companies and subsidiaries would sort of be lifted and be elucidated a little bit strongly, because it's an interesting area as well. How parent companies relate to subsidiary companies, whether that has also necessitated some paradigm shifts here and there.
That is correct, because most of the, not necessarily most, but some of the scams by parent companies have been perpetrated through that relationship. That relationship has been actually exploited to facilitate those scams.
Thank you. As we continue, we will be starting with chapter 2. This is the...
Sorry, Chair, once again, just a small comment. Like, what does strike me is that whilst at conclusion of chapter 1, we're referring to public interest companies, reference is made to annual meetings being compulsory. And I just missed the financial statement side, but does that imply that for non-CI companies, annual meetings are not compulsory? If it's the case, why?
Just to respond quickly, yes, they are not compulsory by way of legislation, but it doesn't mean that they shouldn't hold annual meetings. The annual meetings will be held in accordance with their memorandum of incorporation. The memorandum of incorporation will provide as to when and how many meetings they will be holding in a year. This is because, you know, the company which is closely held will usually hold meetings as and when it needs to. And in some cases, there may be no need for a properly constituted meeting, and decisions could be taken through round robin, where, you know, it could be taken by way of telephonic conversations and under such circumstances to require a statutorily constituted meeting which will serve no purpose merely just for the purposes of term compliance will basically defeat the purpose of the company side. And at any rate, because they would take decisions. And therefore, why do you require a statutorily constituted meeting for such companies? On the issue of Chapter 2, you will realize that the first part deals with incorporation and legal status. And I must point out at the beginning that this particular chapter mainly addresses that objective of simplification of company registration procedures and the reduction of costs associated therewith. The second issue of the reduction of costs associated therewith will be dependent, obviously, on the number of forms that one has to lodge. And what happens is that the reduction of forms will necessarily lead to the reduction of costs, but the cost will actually be determined by way of regulations rather than by way of legislation. But it is our understanding that once we have achieved the purpose or the objective of reducing the number of forms that are required for the purposes of registration, it is likely that all the costs associated with the registration will be decreased dramatically. Now, the chapter attempts the incorporation of a company as a right, and it permits at least one person to form a business corporation or for-profit company. And it requires at least three persons to form a not-for-profit company, as opposed to the current legislation which requires at least seven persons. Therefore, under these circumstances, the law has been simplified quite greatly, because it means that one incorporator is able to incorporate both a widely held company and a closely held company. And only three persons are required for the purposes of incorporating a not-for-profit company. And this particular provision is in line with many of the provisions of the best practice jurisdictions with which we share our company law traditions, which include the United States of America by way of the Model Business Corporations Act. By the way, the Model Business Corporations Act is the legislation which is drafted and reviewed on a continuous basis by the American Bar Association, and this legislation has been adopted by over half of the American states as their primary corporate legislation, and another half of the American states have adopted some parts of the Model Business Corporations Act as their law. And as such, we can say that it is a regulatory environment for many business corporations in the U.S. And also the Delaware General Corporation Law, which is the corporation law that, or in terms of which, over half of the companies that have their shares listed on the New York Stock Exchange are registered in terms of this law, and also the Maryland Corporation Law, which is has got the second highest number of companies that are registered on the New York Stock Exchange, and also the UK Companies Act, which is the latest legislation to be reviewed among all these company jurisdictions with which we share our common law, our company law tradition. Furthermore, the bill tries to facilitate company formation through the adoption of a short form memorandum of incorporation and notice of incorporation. What this short form memorandum of incorporation envisages is that there will be, in Schedule 1, a memorandum of incorporation that will be applicable across the board as a model for mainly your closely held companies, or companies that are prepared to adopt such memorandum without any form of change or amendment to such a memorandum of incorporation. Under such circumstances, such companies need not draft their own memorandum of incorporation, but they may adopt that memorandum of incorporation as their own. And therefore, incorporation will be facilitated quite greatly, because the only document that the company will have to fill will be the notice of incorporation, which must be filed with the commission.
what is interesting is that in order to take forward the objective of facilitating the design and investment in South Africa, the legislation has provided for a very flexible regime of incorporation, mainly because there's a realization that this legislation will be regulating, on the one hand, your mom and pop company, which runs a cold drink shop at the corner in Guguletu, as opposed to your multinational corporation like Anglo American, which will be having investors throughout the world. And as such, there's a need for flexibility in such a legislation, where you would have provisions that are alterable in the legislation that could actually be altered by the company in the memorandum of incorporation, and thereby be made more particularly relevant to the company under question. And you would need provisions that are unalterable that must be adopted by every company in South Africa, in which case those types of provisions will actually be adopted by almost all your closely held companies. And on the other hand, you need to force provisions where if there is no provision to the effect required, then the legislation will actually provide for you as to what the position is. And therefore, this legislation has been drafted in such a way that it provides for alterable, unalterable, and divorce provisions so that it can cater for all the types of businesses that are incorporated under corporate legislation. As such, it may be impossible to write a memorandum of incorporation for every type of company, but there's an acknowledgement that if you are going to draft your own memorandum of incorporation, then you must consider that there are unalterable provisions in the bill with which you must comply, and secondly, those alterable provisions that are in the bill, you must be able to alter them in line with the bill, and thirdly, you must know that there are default provisions that will be applicable to you if you do not adopt any particular position in your memorandum of incorporation. But the understanding is that a model form of a memorandum of incorporation that will be attached to every one of the bill will be a form that will be used across the board for closely held companies, which will mostly be your own and managed company without any form of alteration. And therefore, they will be subject to all alterable and unalterable provisions of the Companies Act, and will also be subject to the default provisions in case they have not provided for any eventuality in a particular matter, as will all the companies. The first point here actually emphasizes what I have just said. And in addition to your memorandum of incorporation, the bill envisages, in terms of section 14, the adoption or the power to be able to adopt internal rules of governance by a company. Now, this is a new thing in South African corporate environment. It has been encouraged by the fact that in some cases, your public interest companies may need to take decisions swiftly, decisions that may not necessarily be required to be taken by the shareholders, for example. The shareholders may agree that certain decisions may be taken by the directors, and as far as if they agree in the memorandum of incorporation that directors have got the power to do certain things by way of the rules, they need to, the legislation must be able to allow them to come up with such rules of governance that will and facilitate proper and efficient business decision within companies. And this will be undertaken by way of internal rules of governance.
If the managers are allowed to have the internal rules, what will happen if those rules are contrary to the rules, to the labor laws of the country? Is there not going to be a contradiction there? country add something there to also guard against contravening the labor law?
On the same point, doesn't that negate the whole spirit of the act? Because the directors can take decisions which are self-serving.
Mr. Chairperson, can I respond? Yeah, on coming to the issue of the conflict between labor relations legislation and any of the rules. The rules are not envisaged to take precedence over any kind of legislation, and even over this particular legislation. And one thing that I must emphasize in relation to the point made by Honorable Member Turok is that the rules of governance, the directors do not necessarily have this by virtue of being directors of the company. It is only when they are given this power by the memorandum of incorporation, and the memorandum of incorporation is put together by the shareholders. And it is only under such circumstances that they will have the power to adopt internal rules concerning governance and of the company. And these internal rules need not be in contradiction with the act or with the memorandum of incorporation itself.
Follow up, Chair. You know, I think there's a basic issue here. And on several occasions, your colleagues have referred to the shareholder meetings and so on. But you know, the newspapers are full of stories, especially personal finance, Bruce Cameron, people like that, full of stories of so many occasions when shareholder meetings are manipulated, when directors organize it in such a way that the shareholders are unable to attend or don't know about it, not properly informed. You know, I start off on the assumption that a company is run for profit and the directors will do what they can to get profit. That's the first thing. Everything else is sequential. Now, our job is to say, of course, we want companies to manage their affairs so they get profit. That's why we're here. But that must not be done at the cost of democracy, accountability, reporting, shareholders, and so on. So what I'm saying is that the whole question of accountability to shareholders, you can't just say the law, the memorandum, is subject to the shareholders. But, you know, people manipulate shareholders all the time. The media are full of stories of manipulating shareholders. So the shareholders are not enough. We are the custodians of the morality of South Africa, although it might sound unlikely, but it's true.
Follow up still on that one. I would like to understand what was the reason of including this, if any way the shareholders can say that in the memorandum. What is it addressing? Because it becomes very difficult to understand, because if you say the shareholders can give those powers anyway without this clause, why do you have to include it?
Thank you, members. I did say this was going to be a long walk, and I didn't say it was a long walk of freedom. Could we have a rejoinder to some of the comments, if possible?
Yeah, just to tackle one point here in relation to the Parliament being the
custodian
of the morality, so to say. I do not think that by way of legislation we should be able to restrict what the shareholders would actually want, particularly if they would like to give certain powers to the directors of the company so that they could take decisions that need not require them to hold meetings. Because shareholders may deem it unnecessary that certain decisions would require their involvement. Otherwise, then every decision of importance may actually require a shareholder meeting, which usually takes a long time to to convene in a public interest company, for example, with many shareholders. And if they feel that such a board of directors is actually qualified for it to be take a decision under such circumstances, we do not see why the legislation should actually restrict that. Obviously, subject to the decisions being taken or the powers that are given to them, being subject to this act and any other legislation that prevails in South Africa. The second issue is, why do we provide for it specifically if the shareholders can be able to do it anyway? The issue, the point is that it was never something that was provided for in the legislation before. And it has been pointed out in our statement, in our negotiations with stakeholders, that that particular provision may need to be expressly provided for, so that at least when that those rules of governance have been created, they have got statutory backing. Otherwise, then they may sort of fall upon common law to say that only the memorandum of incorporation prevails under such circumstances, and it will make it difficult for companies to take decisions that would require maybe a credit manager to take a decision. And someone may argue that there was supposed to have been a shareholder meeting under such circumstances where a credit manager could have taken a decision without the need to revert to the shareholders in the shareholder meeting, which can take time. I mean, you need to have notices and you need to send those notices to the shareholders. You need to send proxies to shareholders as well as those together with those notices. And you need to hold that meeting within a prescribed time in terms of the act, and by which time maybe a very important decision that needed to have been taken would actually be very relevant by the time that the meeting is held.
Jay, can I just follow up very quickly? That makes sense, obviously. You can't have super democracy in a company. But can't you restrict those rules so that to say, except insofar as a decision might benefit the board of directors or its, et cetera, something like that, so that itself, my point was, self-serving. Because what the media are full of are cases where the directors have a meeting, give themselves bonuses and preference shares and all sorts of things, without the agreement of the shareholders. I'm not talking about running the business. Obviously, the CEO must run the business. He can't have a democratic anarchy. But the point is to protect the... If I buy a share in a company, for 1 rand, and this is my investment, I don't want to be involved in running the company, but I do want to know that my rand is not going to be stolen by the CEO. And that does happen by insider trading, by all sorts of mechanisms.
Thank you, Honorable Member. But I must just point out that the protection of shareholders is taken care of somewhere else. This is only the rules of governance of the company that relate to the governance of companies by the shareholders. The issues relating to regulation of loans is dealt with under Section 92A. The issue relating to the responsibilities of the directors and their accountability to the shareholders is undertaken, is provided for under Section 91, which provides for fiduciary duties and duties of care and skill. And under such circumstances, it will be possible for a shareholder to say, but even though you took this decision, it was actually not in line with your standard of conduct as provided for in the legislation, and therefore I'm going to sue you that you pay up in terms of this legislation, and therefore there are provisions to take care of that.
I'm Richard, and then Mayor.
Maybe, Chair, one of the things that the President can help us with, just triggered in my mind, is that you speak of rules, but also the policies. Even a company must set up at least one or two policies on specific things, on how it invests and how it just funds and diversifies. Things that would have an impact on the future of the company, this expansion and all those things. If we could get a comment on that, I mean, there's policy on one side and there's the policy that would inform rules, systems and regulations. I hope I'm clear, because I'm just provoking the component of policy. Because, okay, let me be open. I would definitely strongly maintain that policy framework should be a preserve of shareholder activism, because that's a paradigm shift they're introducing, so that directors and management can then be guided by policy to handle rules, regulation systems and everything. How do you put it?
Thank you. Ma'am Julie?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I was going to say maybe the rules should be in line with the policies that govern that particular company. But for now, Mr. President, I want to propose that we flag this and go and look into it and come back to it, because to me it's not right. There's something wrong with this, that we must go and sit down and try to check on the whole bill itself and come back to it.
I'll give you that mic and then we'll take a rejoinder.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. I guess it's always going on all this. Because you see, to me it seems this clause is giving this directors a leeway to steal. Because if you say they must decide, and it even gives them a leeway, the law even gives them a leeway to go and hold a meeting in Burundi where they can steal correctly. They even run away from the state. You see, that is the way I see this thing. The way I look at these things, I must understand it in such a way that I can be able to explain to people in my constituency. I wouldn't like to complicate it for myself. Because what if you take it up? Does it give any problems? We just throw this clause out. Because the shareholders will determine. But if you put it in specifically, it gives me a problem. Thank you.
No, good folks. We are walking through the entire legislation, the bill, as it stands right now. And it's our responsibility to flag issues. And also the presenters, in fairness, would mention that there are certain aspects that we are flagging now, but not the entire principle is caught in the section that we are dealing with. Thus, they would refer to other sections that are coming up. So, we have flagged these issues adequately. So, let us go through the rest of the chapters and engage in all the other issues. And then also, just by way perhaps of a very short comment, it is true that the legislation that the draft legislation that's put in front of us seeks to deal with South Africa in the context of international relations and what's happening there as well. So it's our responsibility to be able to engage in that process. Let me make a very simple example, perhaps. Old Mutual has been a South African company for the past 60, 70, or 80 years, or something like that. A year or two ago, the Minister of Finance, South African government, was not able to hold them back from listing on the London Stock Exchange, as opposed to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. So that means that they are able to move their assets as they will. They do not necessarily look at the interest of the country. So you have that reality, and you have the responsibility of engaging that reality as best as we can. This is also where the aspect should come in of allowing people to meet elsewhere. We cannot only restrict them to meet in South Africa. Then there will be legal provisions. There are others that are able to list on the London Stock Exchange, other stock exchanges, but there are others that also list on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and others. So there are rules and regulations that go with all these listings. So that we need to look at where the South African legislation comes into play and how we engage with this entire process as best as we can with the interests of the economic citizens of this country, with the interests of South Africa within this international dynamic. So we are all agreed here. I don't think we sit on different sides of the fence in regard to the interests of the country. So we have to raise the issues as we understand them, as you rightly say, using the cover of being a peasant from Limpopo. You can use whatever cover you want. The objective is the same, to critically engage in the rules, legislation, draft legislation in front of us, so that at the end of this process, we have all put our hands together constructively critical in order to produce the best legislation possible under the circumstances. So we are walking along that road. As we are saying that we feel strongly about certain aspects, those are being noted. We are noting it ourselves. They are also noting it where we say that we are not happy with the content, we are not happy with the wording. We'll come back to those issues. But we can't just say that this particular clause, let us expand it right now and not look at the bearing that it has with regard to other chapters. So I'm saying that it's going to be a long walk. Let us engage the issues, raise whatever you need to raise. But in order to do justice to something, you have to listen to all sides and go through all the relevant chapters. Thank you. You can respond to the comments made. I was making more a general point.
Yeah, on the first issue of the rules being in line with policies of the company, we can provide for that. I mean, I don't see any problem that we can provide for that. But the problem is, you know, this legislation is actually aimed at all companies, and if you are going to be specific in relation to every type of company, you would need as many corporate legislation as there are numbers of companies in South Africa. And I don't think that under such circumstances we would have would make good use of our legislative processes. And the other issue is that the policies that they come up with will not be against or in contravention of this legislation and will not be in contravention of the memorandum of incorporation of the company, because the legislation says that those rules need not be against or in contravention of those two particular important instruments. And I also agree with Honorable Member who said that this issue needs to be looked at. We are still looking at it as well in line of the comments that we have received. And indeed, I think we've got one or two comments that actually pointed to this issue, and we are considering it. And also thank you for Mr. Chairperson's overall view. And we must also have regard to the fact that internationally, best practice jurisdiction with which we share company law traditions do have this kind of a provision. And we find that it may be unrealistic for South Africa to expect not to have it when we are expecting to have foreign direct investment, and we are providing for something that may be very unfamiliar to our investment partners, and to such an extent that it will be very difficult to attract any kind of investment directly into the country. And sadly, the issue of the right to steal and the right to steal legally, I do not think that this particular power, that this particular provision actually gives the power to the directors to do that. Because you have not, you mustn't read it in isolation. It must be read in the context, because there are certain provisions in the bill itself which provide for conduct of the directors. For example, in Section 91, which provides for standards of conduct, as I've already pointed out, provides for the fiduciary duties and duties of care and skill upon the directors of the company. And it also provides in Section 92A the regulation of the provision of loans to the directors. And under such circumstances, it will not be easy for the directors to be able to steal And if they do so, they would be going against the law. And indeed, they would find the might of the law against them. Having said that, however, let me go on to say that...
I think your colleagues would also like to comment.
No, thanks. I think I would like to emphasize that if we agree that this act has to be read as a whole, the section in the act, but if we read them as a whole, we may find that these issues we are talking about are dependent on other sections. That's why my colleague is saying it's to be read within the context. And then if we strengthen the enforcement part of it, for it to be deterrent, as an example, there will be two or three cases of manipulation. But if the culture of corporate governance goes well, then within the context, I think this is well situated. Otherwise, to take out this memorandum of understanding, there won't be any area to run the company. So that's my comment.
Yeah, just
maybe
a follow-up. We must remember that the company is based on contract. And like any other contract or contracting parties, shareholders should be able to have their own rules. But the Act is also clear that those rules cannot violate the Act. And for example, would be Clause 35, which says that despite any single contract, in the company's memorandum of incorporation, every share has got a vote. That we cannot have a voteless share, subject to certain exceptions. And therefore, the Act provides for alterable and unalterable provisions in the Act, meaning that unalterable provisions, you cannot amend them, or you cannot have rules which contradict the unalterable provisions as stated in the Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think the concerns that are being raised by the honourable members are probably very valid and noted. I think the challenge here, in the introduction, Mr. Mongalo mentioned that one of the policy objectives really is to try and achieve simplicity and flexibility in terms of company formation and registration. But on the other hand, we are saying that we also want to maintain very high standards of corporate governance. So to the extent that there are probably certain provisions that may seem to be overly simplistic or giving a lot of simplifying issues and at the same time compromising corporate governance, we just need to probably have a look at that. I think the test really is in the formation of those provisions. And I agree that maybe we just need to flag the issue and go back and have a look at it and see how best we can provide or qualify some of those issues. Thank you.
Yeah, I
don't think that the need for my learned friends here to justify what is written down here. The question is, let's flag the issue, go back, yourself and ourselves, look into the issue, and also to add on what I said, let's also get this Modern Business Corporations Act, this Delaware, Geneva, corporate laws, and this Maryland corporate law, and the UK Companies Act, look into this act themselves. And try to go back to what he is saying now and check whether this cannot be amended in a particular way or removed or rewritten in another way. Because to try to justify this now, we are looking at a certain direction, and you are also looking at a certain direction. We'll end up making a dialogue. Let's flag it and look at it.
Okay, having said said that, I think there's a common understanding that this issue is flagged. Yeah. The bill goes on, particularly in this chapter, to simplify the filing requirements, particularly in relation to the memorandum of incorporation. I pointed out that there would be a memorandum of incorporation, model memorandum of incorporation attached to Schedule 1, which will be adopted without any alteration by the closely held companies. And the bill abolishes the need for such a memorandum of incorporation to be certified by a notary public, which is a specialized attorney, and which usually comes at a cost and the requirement for a seal. Briefly, therefore, the bill only mandates a public interest company to file its memorandum of incorporation, and a closely held company does not have to lodge its memorandum of incorporation with the commissioner, but has to keep the memorandum of incorporation at its registered office and can be accessible to whoever wants to have access to it, shareholders and other public other people who have got an interest in, it. At any rate, incorporators of a closely held company do not have to draft their memorandum but may adopt a model memorandum into the one as I've already pointed out. And as a result, the bill also goes forward to abolish the constructive notice doctrine, in the sense that a person is not deemed to have a notice or knowledge of the contents of any document relating to a company merely because the document has been filed with the commissioner or is accessible for inspection at an office of the company. Now, that the doctrine of constructive notice has been part of our law ever since South Africa adopted company law in 1926, and even prior to that, the different provinces that formed the Union of South Africa adopted different legislative enactments that came from the UK. Constructive notice has always been part of our law, in the sense that every time a document is filed at the registrar's office, every member of the public was deemed to have knowledge of the contents of such document. And the bill provides that, insofar as that is concerned, in Section 15, Subsection 4, that constructive notice doctrine is abolished, in line with what is happening in other countries, where a person, the mere fact that a document has been filed or the document is available for inspection at the office of the company, does not necessarily mean that the member of the public has got knowledge of the contents of such a document. I think it is a positive move in the right direction, because otherwise it will be going backwards from what other jurisdictions are doing. The bill also provides for the expanded negation of the ultra vires defense in an attempt to provide further assurance and protection of persons dealing with the company in good faith. This is in Section 27. What the ultra vires doctrine also did was that it is a doctrine that says if the company does not have certain capacity, then the company or a director who acts on behalf of the company in relation to a matter that is ultra vires, that capacity of the company, then that transaction is the void ab initio, is void as if it has never come into existence, which obviously then leads to the abrogation of the rights of all the parties to the contract. But now the company's bill, or the Companies Act of 1973, has provided for a defense where it said that even if a company does something that is in excess of its capacity, the third-party contractor should not be prejudiced by the fact that the company did not have capacity. And if that is the only reason why the company should, or the contract should not stand, under such circumstances, the court will allow the contract to stand, regardless of the fact that the company did not have capacity. This legislation goes on to say that the company will have the capacity of an individual or a natural person, in which case it means that the company will have almost the capacity to do almost everything and anything that is capable of doing as a juristic person through the direction of the director. And protecting the rights of the company the bill provides that where the company has done something that is not in line with the memorandum of incorporation, the shareholders will have the right to demand that the directors have acted in excess of their powers or the power that they have provided to them, and under such circumstances they may compensate the company for the loss that they would have caused to the company. And also the third party who transacted in good faith will still be protected because the contract will not be declared void ab initio. And therefore the bill goes on to provide also for the parties to the pre-incorporation contract. A pre-incorporation contract, honorable members, is a contract that is entered into by the company before it is officially incorporated. An example could be a lease agreement where an incorporator of the company realizes that there is a property that is available for renting, and it is available now while he is still lodging the documents for the incorporation of the company, and it may not be available at a later stage. And in order to ensure or to facilitate the transaction, an incorporator may approach the owner of the premises for a lease agreement, but the incorporator may not want to be held personally liable in respect of that contract, because that contract will be for the benefit of the company, although the company is not yet formed. The law basically under Section 35 of the current Companies Act allows such an incorporator to do that. But it doesn't go further to provide for the eventualities under such circumstances. We think that this is one of the most progressive moves in the legislation, which is aligned to other jurisdictions that are with which we share companies or traditions, where it provides for eventualities parties to the contract as to what happens if the company is not ultimately incorporated, and what if the company is ultimately incorporated but does not ratify the contract, what happens to the parties who entered into the contract on behalf of the company not yet formed. And therefore, in that sense, it is actually in line with international development. If I may, Mr. Chairperson, let me just put it this way, honorable members. A company is a legal person, is a juristic person. But it's a juristic person that really is incapacitated in the sense that it has to act through its controller and usually the director. And as such, a company is not a legal person until it is incorporated, until you receive a notice of incorporation from the registrar to the effect that your company is now a person and can enter into contract. Then, at common law, if the company is not yet in existence, it's like a person who is not in existence. And at common law, you can never enter into a contract binding someone who does not exist. That is common law. Therefore, if the legislation did not come into force or into place to give the rights of the company that is not yet in place but which is going to be incorporated, there were going to be a lot of difficulties for companies to be able to enter into good faith contracts. Now, if I want to enter into a contract on a good faith, but I know that my company is not yet incorporated, but we are in the process of incorporating a company, And I know that the common law is not going to allow me to enter into a contract where I bind the company that does not exist. Then the legislation must come into place to help me where I do not want to be personally liable. Because one point that we need to remember is that a company is basically a person on his own, and it is actually the bearer of responsibility, and also it has got its own rights and obligations. Where a company enters into a contract, it is a company that is obliged to see to it that it complies with that contract, and not the members of the company or the shareholders or the directors of the company. Therefore, the company has got its responsibilities towards the contract as opposed to any member. Therefore, as a person, when you enter into a contract on behalf of the company, it is the company that must pay whatever that is due to be paid to the third party, and not the person who enters into the contract on behalf, unless there is some sort of defraud that happened. But under normal circumstances, if I've got my own estate, let's say I've amassed a lot of personal estate, I've got 30 million rand in the bank, but I happen to be a director of a company, that does not really do very well. And the company enters into a contract with another person, and the company is therefore liable to pay that person 1 million rand. That particular person is not allowed to look at my personal estate and want me to pay on behalf of the company, because the company is a separate person, separate from myself. Although people talk about my company, in legal sense, there is nothing like that. A company is a separate legal person, which is separate from the person who even forms it. And under such circumstances, if a company does not exist, it will be impossible to make it a party to the contract. Therefore, the law is facilitating that process of making a party to the contract, making a company a party to the contract even before it is incorporated. Because under such circumstances, you may lose certain commercial advantages if that is not catered for. And this is not a new thing. It has actually been provided for under Section 35 of the Companies Act and Section 53 of the Close Corporations Act, and many other corporate legislation throughout the world are providing for pre-incorporation contracts. But what we are saying is that we have realized that there is a deficiency in the current provision, in the sense that the current provision does not provide for eventualities upon the parties to the contract, particularly a person who enters into a contract on behalf of the company not yet formed. Because under such circumstances, a person will not be personally liable, but the company will be. But what if the company does not become incorporated ultimately? Or what if the company is incorporated, but the company does not adopt that contract into which the person has professed to act or to enter into on his behalf? Therefore, under such circumstances, the law should come into play. Usually what used to happen under the current legislation is that lawyers would actually make a lot of money out of this, because they would have to provide in the legislation for such eventualities. And we are saying, why doesn't the legislation just provide for what happens under such circumstances?
Okay. In business, there's nothing like good faith. Business is business, and the name of the game is profit. So okay. I don't know.
I suppose, amongst other things, because I share the same anxiety, but it's just that, you know, law is a very complex, you know, environment. You know, you look at one section or you look at one law, but you must read it in conjunction with the other. Am I reading it correctly, particularly around the issue of good faith, that there are safety measures which may be provided elsewhere to counter that, or in other pieces of legislation? A good example is that we're setting up this new company, it's incorporated. And because I know that if we go and rent in a certain place, it's my bride, even if the rent is high, you know, I'll get a kickback. The company gets incorporated, the liability is on the company's shoulders, right? Then thereafter we discover that Usisa made this cookie, but it's already locked. But then I don't want to pose it as if I made it clear, so that doesn't that mean that there are other measures elsewhere that if that gets discovered, the liability may be held liable for the the unsavory activity that I've done. I think that's the uneasiness. But the other, the good faith is that it's good that if it would have been a bargain to pick up a couple of vehicles before or to get a rental in a certain favorable area, but so that by the time the company is incorporated, would have been able to secure, you know, accommodation or offices. But there's the dark side of the moon as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I think that is catered for through the breach of fiduciary responsibilities of a director under the Companies Act. And if you do something like that in bad faith, then since you are under a fiduciary responsibility to the company, then you will be held personally liable. And because even under criminal law, you can be held liable for fraud. And therefore, you are actually in between two stones, really. I don't know if any of my colleagues would like to come and check.
I may just, add that this issue has resonated through the courts. There are decided cases on it. There have been really contingent or borderline cases. There are old cases, as far back as 1920, of situations where conduct of this kind was found and rules were formulated around that, where a person acts in bad faith to his benefit or indirect benefit on the back of the company. And the courts have ruled simply that if you acquire, for instance, I know in Robinson's decision, the court ruled that, you know, if you acquire anything on the back of the company for your own benefit, you must take all what you've gained, including its profits, into the company. I mean, it's a question of fiduciary duty. So it is something, it's just the codification of common law of long standing. So the catchword here is good faith or bad faith. Anything that you've done is bad faith. I mean, it's clearly outside fiduciary duty. The court will come in and clamp down on it. And I know that... Oh, okay. So,
as the king who wrote the King Committee and the Code of Good Governance, always makes a comment when he gives a briefing on codification of governance. And he says there's one thing that you can never codify is ethics. And ethics is a big part of what to play in the corporate world. He says you can't codify debt. You can't codify flaws. The person's going to do what they're going to do. For example, in the big scandal that we've seen in America about the Enron and the WorldComs, the one thing that came out very strongly in those particular court cases was that there is a strong regulation in America called Sarbanes-Oxley, which regulates corporate governance in America, but it still went on and happened. So a lot of the debate that's going on is the debate about the qualification of how people are going to act in terms of their corporate responsibility. And that is simply not possible in terms of the corporate structures and the corporate world in which people revolve around them. So people, if they're going to steal before in terms of a pre-incorporation contract and they're going to defraud, they're still going to do it, even if the regulation and the legislation is back. It's just a matter of putting the environment in place in which people play a particular game in terms of the way it is regulated.
So to wrap it up, the other requirement is that it's always important is this thing of disclosure. I think if a person discloses that, look, I know of some cheap premises elsewhere which can benefit the company that you're trying to form, but let me tell you that's my brother's house, and then if the people know beforehand that that is the case, then there is no problem. So the question of, the doctrine of disclosure is very integral in corporate law. So just a little flag that.
I'll allow you, man, to listen.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know what? It's in business. The name of the game is what do you gain? Now, it doesn't matter whether you have done what you are doing in good faith or in bad faith. The issue here is where do you find yourself landing at the end of everything? People have done a lot of things in good faith, but today they are standing in front of court. they are paying lots and lots of money. If maybe you can furnish us with one or two or three cases that you have looked into, the ones done in bad faith and the ones done in good faith, so that we look at it and then try to look at whether what is standing in this act will help our people. Because we are not talking of big guys only here, we are also talking of small people. I think we need to do that. We need to look at this thing from all angles so that we satisfy ourselves that what we are doing is not going to lead our people to jail in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. If you'd like to respond, you may do so. But I can see even the computer is tired.
I can just apologize.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I'm sure we'll be able to call some technicians to come and assist to get it up to speed. But also, we're supposed to go on lunch, have a lunch break at 12:30. By the cheapest wash in the room, it's according to one now. So I would propose that we do take a body break and then resume by 1:30.
Cool.
Let's take lunch, sort out whatever needs to be sorted out in the computer, and then just take some break to recapture our breath. A lot of water flowed under the bridge this morning. Thank you, good focus.
Thank you. Yeah, already, sorry. Yeah, go. Cool. So, may I just say this spot? You need to leave. Like, yeah. No, yeah, I sent the message already. And I just got a delivery report now. So, yeah, it's great. Probably, yeah. Yeah, it's going until, it seems like it's going on until like 5:30 or something.
And I sent you what's required. You don't have to do it like
he said, yeah.
Just say what the presentation was about, as far as you got.
Yeah.
And then just the main issues that were raised by
Okay, cool.
What is happening, like, why don't you have a look at public service and administration?
Okay.
You can look for the public service amendment bill, right? And then also workshop. And look at that.
Okay. All right, perfect.
So we don't need
anything. Yeah. Okay, cool, perfect. I didn't mean log off, I'm just saving it.
No,
I'm going to
You need to enter the desktop.
Well, yeah.
The phone is still in there at 1:40.